The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
It has been revealed, thanks to SIPO declarations, that one out of every five sitting TDs is a landlord. 32 of 174 TDs declaring rental income last year. Carl Dieter, business journalist, is with us. Carl, the question I think that this raises is whether or not the fact that so many TDs are landlords is likely to skew how they legislate in relation to matters pertaining to rental income and landlord rights.
I don't know that it does. And also, if you look into it, I mean, the fact that they own shares, does that change how we do foreign direct investments? Their kids go to schools. Does that change education policy? I think the whole idea of electing people is they have enough objectivity to try to make the right choice. Equally, most of them in this are actually quite small-time landlords. So you'd have people, in one instance, you know, it's a share of a cottage up a Boreen. So I don't think that's the kind of thing that will necessarily, you know, split your personality to the point where you'd be making, you know, big vested interest decisions. So that wouldn't be the main concern I would have. My main concern is actually about the standards in public office declarations, which came out yesterday, because they're not standard. You've got a lot of people who, you know, some will declare holiday homes. So Alan Kelly, for instance, he says, yeah, I've got a share in a holiday home. But, you know, in the past, even the Taoiseach of the country, while I can't say that he owns a holiday home now, but it has been published in the past that he had part of a holiday home, and it was never on his declaration. So there's a lot of discrepancies in how this stuff is reported. You could have $40 million in cash. That doesn't have to go on the declaration. Would that influence you, for instance, if we ever had to do another bank guarantee? Would it influence you if you felt banks should pay depositors more? So there's a lot of things that fall through the cracks with SIPO.
But if we stay on the property issues, Carl, the SIPO declarations, my understanding was that you had to declare any interest above, I think it's €13,000 in property, and that was the norm for everybody.
Okay, so let me break that down. You have to declare the interest, true, but you don't, for instance, if it's a property that you use for personal reasons. So a lot of TDs would end up owning properties in Dublin because they live far away, and they eventually buy apartments here. Because that's used for part of their work, they don't have to mention it. If you have a holiday home that's used for your own enjoyment, you don't have to mention it. So that 13,000 rule doesn't come into play. Equally, though, you also have a wild discrepancy where some people will say a farm of 100 acres of meat. Now, 100 acres of meat probably cost you in excess of €1.5 million. And so you have some idea of the quantum of the land and the value of it. You get an idea of how vested they are. But others will just say farmland. So, you know, I was looking through the declarations and Matty McGrath says farmland on a mountain. He doesn't say the size. In fact, a lot of them don't. But that farmland could be 20 acres. It could be 2,000 acres. You know, and you can go and you can look into this in the land registry. I did it in 2018. You know, we made a political rich list that looked at the detailed analysis of the TDs. And just the whole process of all the declarations is just broken, and there's a million ways to get around it.
But even if we take what has already been declared, we know now that roughly 20% are landlords, which is vastly out of kilter with the norms among the populace that they represent. Why do you think there is such a disproportionate number of TDs who are landlords?
In a sense, it's kind of structural. So there's a few things would happen. One is some of the landlords have constituency offices. So, I mean, that's part of the job. Another one might be that, you know, a lot of the TDs nowadays would be in their 50s, coming towards their 60s. And it was quite common in the early 2000s that, you know, people might buy a house and then settle down. And when they did that, you know, their partners would have kept the house and moved into theirs or vice versa, whatever way it works. You've got a lot of people who have inherited property, and you'll see that declared, like, I've got a half share of, you know, former family homes, etc. You've got some that own B&Bs. So part of it is structural because of the age of TDs. If you were to look at landlords, for instance, they're usually not 21. They're all in this certain age cohort for the most part. Second is this job encourages investment in things like constituency offices. Other times it's B&Bs.
It still seems significantly out of whack. I mean, what's the average percentage of landlords across the country is below, I think, 3%, isn't it? And then you've got 20%. I mean, that is a vast multiple of the norm. And in some instances, the holdings are fairly significant.
But what's the inference, though, Anton? Because, like, a lot of the TDs, they're also not, like, nationally representative. You know, it's a highly paid job. Like, they have to invest in something, stocks and shares, property, whatever. But, like, it's not rare for someone who's highly paid to invest. Equally, if you look down through it in detail, you'll see a lot of them are farmers and they've, you know, maybe built houses on their farmland and they rent those out. Like, that's normal for farmers in general to try and supplement farm income. So I wouldn't see this as being some allusion to potential wrongdoing. In fact, this article comes out every year around the same time when the SIPO declarations do, and I see it really as a rinse and repeat rage bait article. It doesn't really tell us anything, nor does it infer anything in a concrete manner beyond the fact that people who are highly paid and often come from wealthy backgrounds tend to invest in assets and asset classes that are common investments.
But it does give us, I mean, you used the analogy earlier on to, for instance, if you held shares in certain pharma companies, would that influence your thinking in respect of FDI? I think most people's answer would be, well, yes, quite possibly it would. In the same way, does it not give us an insight? So if we look at things, I mean, there's a story today which we may talk about, which is relating to the Residential Tenancies Board and the kind of action that it takes. If you have a disproportionate number of people who are landlords, whether well-meaning or not, are they not intrinsically incentivized to act in their own interest?
I guess that comes down to how you see the kind of the ethical boundary in any profession. You know, the doctors advise on medicines that might help their practice do better, or, you know, I don't know. Like, I'll put it this way, there's nothing concrete there that you can point and say, yes, this shows that, you know, the 20% of the TDs somehow wag the dog that represents the other 80%.
Well, we can point to a national history wherein TDs and councillors trousered vast amount of money to influence the planning system because they were able to benefit for it either in the form of direct payments or in the form of interest that they had in the land that was subsequently changed in the zoning. That is not that long ago.
But that's corruption, Anton. That's not like that's an entirely different thing. I mean, corruption is corruption. It's a crime. So, like, you can't conflate that with what is a kind of a standard enough asset holding by certain age groups, and, you know, or you can't prevent someone's dad from dying and leaving them a home. You know, the fact is a lot of the TDs come from quite what you'd call like minted backgrounds. Now, there are obviously loads that are like just like school teacher, regular stuff, but a lot of them actually were kind of wealthy before politics. And so when that's the case, like, they're going to hold these assets. They're going to be wealthy whether you want them to or not.
But you don't think it has any influence. If somebody is sitting looking at legislation that may look at something, for instance, like a rent cap, and they know that in passing that legislation, it may directly impact their income and their bottom line, you don't think that has any effect on their decisions?
Actually, strangely enough, Anton, you just proved my point. Because back in 2016, when these rent controls came in, the same amount of TDs were landlords. And it wasn't fought back at all. So I guess that kind of answers your question for you, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. That we still have a majority that aren't TDs. What I'm asking about is, are you influenced by your own financial interests?
The people who passed that legislation, it was a Fine Gael thing. A lot of them were landlords, and Simon Coveney at the time, who was the housing minister, also owned several properties. So what I'm saying is, like, there's actually good evidence in what you've just mentioned to show. And in all the subsequent years, that while we have this disproportionate number of property owners, that those rent caps have maintained beyond their initial 3-year period to actually 300% more than they should have been. They're 9 years old now. So it actually shows an enduring ability to perhaps act against what you would expect would be their own self-interest.
I mentioned earlier on that story relating to the watchdog, that being the RTB, and there's reports suggesting that the watchdog is being criticised for being soft on landlords who are overcharging. What's your take on that?
I think it probably needs to get its enforcement game a bit better. I've been on the other side of that as well, where as a landlord, I won a case against a tenant who was very destructive, and it took about 2 years. the courts awarded me a princely sum, of which I never got a single penny. And that's the thing, is that if you have rules and process without enforcement at the end of it, it becomes very largely a meaningless thing. Thankfully, the kind of the rogue landlord is in the minority. Most people have like normal relationships, and we're seeing a growing kind of professionalism within the landlord classes, where it's bigger landlords who like very much adhere to the books. They don't mess around with the rents, but they will absolutely raise it every year because that's their business model within the legal limit. So that kind of stuff is really frustrating, in particular as someone who's quite positive on the property market in Ireland. Like, we have to get this right. We can't just see it as a dour and bad thing. To solve this, it needs to be growing. It needs to be positive. It needs investment. And stories like this kind of undermine that. So it mostly just enrages me, to be honest.
And does it need the small individual landlord to stay in the market, or is it a positive thing that that shift towards professionalism seems to be happening?
God, that's a tricky one. So, like, you want the professionalism, but the small landlords tend not to have the ability to put the resources into becoming compliance machines in a way that the public kind of expects them to be. So, and by the way, the other thing I would say is, like, small landlords, though, if you look at the dynamic of the relationship, like, quite often their tenants are getting, like, preferential rents and things like that because of the actual relationship. It's not just a spreadsheet exercise relationship. The small landlords have been getting out. Part of that is a timing measure because they bought houses, you know, 20 years ago, and this is the natural time for a long-term asset. Another thing is, you know, they're fed up, they're moving on. A lot of the houses that first-time buyers are buying are coming from small-time landlords exiting. So, like, if they stop doing that, then there'll be less homes for first-time buyers. So everything that you do, there's, like, this domino effect to the next thing. And that's why I'm saying it's so frustrating, because to get this right, we really just need to, get the sector into hyper-productivity in order to catch up and build. And at the same time, like, where I am today, I'm looking out at what will become a building site now, but that was actually sold and you know, was meant to be a housing site 20 years ago, and it's been delayed for two decades. Like, that kind of stuff, that's the kind of stuff that is where the real problems are. It's not to say that the bad landlords aren't the real problem. They're obviously a problem, but the big structural problem is just our ability to get through processes and have modern processes that are understandable with known outcomes. Okay. And we never had it. And that's why you had the corruption in the past, because you used to pay to get done.
Carl, thank you very much. That is Carl Dieter, founder of onlineapplication.com. Text to say, Anton, stop trying to make something out of TDs being landlords. All legislation in the last decade around property has been in favour of tenancies and the absolute opposite of favouring landlords. This is just trying to stir up more anti-government babble and a suggestion of the government favouring landlords when blatantly nothing could be further from the truth. Another, it's madness that one in five TDs is a landlord. We have such poor housing legislation, and I feel like vested interests are a huge cause of that. Landlord TDs know that the best return on investment is being a landlord. Then they'll tell us they want rents to come down. 53106 at a cost of 30 cents if you want to get in touch, or 087 1400 106 on what?
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.